From WBUR in Boston, I'm Bill Littlefield, and this is NPR's Only a Game. Will the Phillies forego the Fall Classic, or will the Giants foil their National League foes? Will the Rangers drag the World Series to Texas, or are the Yankees still the Yankees? Ahead in Only a Game, Tim Kirkjian breaks down the league championship series. Also, Mo Vaughn's second career as a real estate developer, and LPGA star Chris Cheddar talks about her tutelage, courtesy of Ben Hogan. Also, Vince Lombardi finally makes it to Broadway.
Vince Lombardi was a complicated man, someone who was better able to create a sense of family out of a team than out of his own nuclear family. And all of those elements and many more come out in this play.
Stay tuned.
Major funding for Only a Game comes from Oliver Wyman, an international strategy consulting firm. With 3,000 professionals worldwide, Oliver Wyman serves global 1,000 companies. OliverWyman.com.
This is Only a Game. I'm Bill Littlefield. The Giants, never big enough since 1954, have San Franciscans hoping that a series is in store. New Yorkers, hey, it's no big deal. The Yankees win a lot. However, they're delighted with the ball club that they've got. The Phils would like revenge, I guess. At least that's what they say. The Yankees tripped them up last fall, and now perhaps they'll pay. And soaring high above their history are the Texas Rangers. To autumn baseball, they have been, to put it kindly, strangers. Joining me now to comment on all of the above is ESPN's Tim Kirkjian, who's currently in Philadelphia. Tim, welcome back to Only a Game.
Great to be here, Bill.
Tim, the Yankees took the first game of the ALCS last night. Is it accurate to say that both American League finalists are where they are right now because the Rangers dealt Mark Teixeira to the Braves back in 2007?
Absolutely. And because Mark Teixeira was traded, he eventually ended up with the Yankees. And Mark Teixeira is as big a reason as any that the Yankees are where they are. Look at how life might have changed if Mark Teixeira had signed with the Red Sox instead of with the Yankees. That would have been a completely different ball game in the American League East. Instead, he got them to a world championship last year. Plus, look at what the Rangers got in return from Mark Teixeira. It's just remarkable. Elvis Andrews, their shortstop, is a great young player. Neftali Feliz, their closer, set the save record for rookies this year. A tremendous deal for both teams where Teixeira ended up.
This Rangers team would appear to be the underdog in this series. I was surprised to learn that their triumph over Tampa Bay in the divisional series marked the first ever playoff series this team had won. Do they have what it takes to win their second or maybe even a third playoff series?
I think the Yankees are going to win this series, Bill, but anyone who discounts the Rangers has not been watching them play this year. They have the best pitcher, perhaps, in the entire postseason, Cliff Lee, on their team. He will pitch Game 3. He's one of the great postseason pitchers of all time, and he's only made 7 postseason starts. They have an offense that can bludgeon you in the middle of the order and can run the bases with any team in the major leagues. And they had the second-best bullpen ERA in the American League this year. There aren't a whole lot of weaknesses on this Ranger team. The only thing they don't really have is experience in the postseason, but they are gaining that every game they play.
Tim, are you surprised that the Rangers' recent flirtations with bankruptcy and the team's sale didn't seem to take the minds of any of the players off baseball this season?
I am a little surprised because all players are looking for is an excuse to not win the game sometimes. And they'll look at ownership and say, look, they don't even know what they're doing up there. How are we supposed to compete down here? But they went the opposite direction. They said, look, we don't care what's going on up there. We have to take care of our business down here. And not only that, but during all this, they went out and acquired the best pitcher available in Cliff Lee. And I remember Michael Young looking at one of his teammates after hearing the news and just looked at him and said, dude, we got Cliff Lee today. As if to say, dude, we've got a chance now to win this division and do something in the postseason. That's what the near-bankrupt Rangers were looking at, and yet somehow they went out and did something really well during a troubled time.
The Yankees, of course, are the defending champions. They won one for George Steinbrenner last fall, and you seem to think they're going to do it again this fall.
I think they're going to win the pennant again, Bill. I'm not saying they're going to win the World Series, but there's something extra special again with this Yankee team, and maybe it's what we've always seen. Maybe it's Jeter and Rivera and Posada and the rest of those guys. Maybe C.C. Sabathia just gives them a horse at the top of the rotation that we haven't seen in the postseason for quite some time. I just like the mystique that this team has again as they have fought their way through injuries and everything else again this year, and they end up sweeping the Twins in the first round of the playoffs when some people were saying, not me, of course, watch out, they may lose the series. So there's always something to look for with the Yankees and say, wow, they're pretty darn good.
Game one of the National League Championship Series will take place tonight in Philadelphia, where the Giants will hope to steal one or maybe even two against the defending pennant holders. Any chance they do it?
I think there's a chance the Giants can beat the Phillies. I think the Phillies are going to win. But again, anybody who looks past the Giants with the pitching that they have is making a really big mistake. The Giants' ERA in the month of September was 1.78. That was the fifth best ERA any month by any team since 1920. It's unbelievable how well they pitched in September. They have carried it over into October. They're not going to score the runs that the Phillies do, but when they can throw out three starting pitchers, Tim Lincecum, Jonathan Sanchez, Matt Cain, and now Madison Bumgarner as the fourth, that's about as good a pitching as there is in the postseason right now.
Tim Lincecum goes for the Giants tonight, Roy Halladay for the Phillies. This is one of the most ballyhooed pitching matchups in a long time, especially in the postseason, so we can expect, a 12-11 show?
No, we can expect a 2-1 show. Plus, it's going to be a little cool, so it's going to be even harder for the hitters. Let's understand, Bill, it's the two-time defending National League Cy Young winner in Tim Lincecum against Roy Halladay, who is going to win the Cy Young this year in the National League. Each guy is coming off historic postseason starts, two of the top 10, if not better, of all time. That's how good these guys are. And the best part is, Halladay is 7 years older. He's 7 inches taller. He weighs 60 pounds more. He's got a full beard, and I don't think Lincecum even has to shave. They couldn't be more unlike. The only thing they have in common are they're great pitchers, and they both have the middle name of Leroy. Figure that out.
I don't see how we can avoid another perfect game in the World Series the way pitching has been going in this postseason. Don Larsen, move over.
Bill, I'm telling you, if you look at the way this season went, the latest year of the pitcher, I told everyone this is going to extend into the postseason, and it has happened. The starting pitchers who are now in the LCS, what they did in the LDS was just fabulous. They combined for a 1.13 ERA in 15 starts in the LDS, and now we're going to get to see all those guys again in the LCS. I'm telling you, it's going to be 1-0, 2-1, 3-2 all the way through.
Tim Kirkjian is a reporter for ESPN's Baseball Tonight and a senior writer for ESPN, the magazine. Thanks, Tim.
Thank you, Bill.
As Tim mentioned, the San Francisco Giants will face the Philadelphia Phillies in the first game of the National League Championship Series tonight. Back in Atlanta, Braves fans are still thinking about what might have been, but looking forward to the future, even though it will not include longtime manager Bobby Cox on the bench. Philip Gratzer has this report.
This year's Braves team was special, according to Atlanta Journal-Constitution sports columnist Jeff Schultz.
They had a lot of guys who were like on one-year contracts. I don't want to say rejects, but sort of like, you know, these extra parts that sort of somehow pulled together. They had a really strong bench going into the year. When they started to lose starters, those bench guys became starters, and they still kept winning. The mere fact that they made the postseason is one of the more remarkable things I've ever seen.
And when they won a wild card spot, Braves fans started sporting believe buttons and chanting 11 for 6, calling for a postseason run of 3 division wins, 4 National League pennant wins, 4 World Series wins for number 6, retiring manager Bobby Cox. But the Braves could only muster 1 for 6, bowing out to the Giants in 4 games. After the loss, fans called for their manager, Bobby Cox, to take a final bow. And as Cox came out of the dugout, the San Francisco Giants, who were on field celebrating, stopped and tipped their hats to Cox. Later, in the clubhouse, Cox tipped his hat to the fans.
These fans have been great. We appreciate their support, I do, and the players, and I have all through my career here. They've been just absolutely great.
The end of the Braves season also meant the end of the Bobby Cox era. He's retiring after 29 years as a major league manager, 25 of them with the Braves. Cox had a big influence on the players, and catcher Brian McCann thinks the next manager has big cleats to fill.
He's a legend. I grew up in Atlanta as a fan. I got the chance to play for him. And I feel very, very lucky to be on the team that was his last season. So he's an amazing person, amazing manager. He's everything right that's in baseball.
Braves management moved quickly to replace Cox. General manager Frank Wren had been in talks with Freddie Gonzalez since July and made the announcement just 2 days after the season was over.
Today we feel like we've got the ideal guy for the job. Not only his standing as being part of the Braves organization for a number of years, but his relationship to Bobby, his relationship to all of us, and our ability to watch him over the course of time, get a chance to manage for the first time with the Florida Marlins. We just think he's the ideal fit for our ball club.
Gonzalez is no stranger to the Braves. In 2002, he managed their AAA team in Richmond. From 2003 to 2006, he served under Cox as the Braves' third base coach. He managed the Florida Marlins for 3.5 seasons before being fired in June this year. Although he says he won't be exactly like Cox, Gonzalez isn't promising big changes either.
I'm not going to come in and just change the whole culture, because some of my stuff that I learned as a manager, I learned from being with Bobby and from the Atlanta Braves organization. So for me to come in here and throw a hand grenade in there and just start from scratch and change the letter A and the color scheme, that is crazy. There's a lot of good stuff here. There's a lot of good baseball players here. And again, there's going to be some differences, but, you know, it's not going to be something that's crazy.
But there's one area where Gonzalez is unlike Cox. He'll call out a player publicly when he steps out of line, like when he benched Marlins star Hanley Ramirez when he threw a fit in June. Gonzalez has already announced his coaches, and next week he'll be at the Braves' annual organizational meeting in Florida to evaluate players in the instructional league and figure out how to get the 2 or 3 position players the Braves will need to be postseason contenders next year. For Only a Game, I'm Philip Gratzer in Atlanta.
It's 19 minutes past the hour.
Liu Wei.
The director of the Chinese version of the Got Talent TV show made popular in Great Britain is certain that the show will be popular for years because, quote, China has so much untapped grassroots talent. One possessor of some of that talent won the first series of competitions recently by tapping on the piano with his toes. Liu Wei lost his arms in an accident when he was 10, taught himself to play the piano with his feet 5 years ago, and is now headed to Las Vegas for a 3-month engagement. Liu Wei rose to the top of China's Got Talent by playing and singing You're Beautiful, and reportedly won over the judges by saying, at least I have a perfect pair of legs.
You're beautiful, you're beautiful, you're beautiful.
I'm Bill Littlefield, ahead on Only a Game. A Ben Hogan protege, no slouch herself, remembers the legendary golfer. But first, Mo Vaughn is best known as a first baseman and slugger who was named MVP of the American League in 1995. Vaughn played for the Red Sox, the Angels, and the Mets before his career ended in 2003 after a series of injuries. After failing to succeed with investments in a nightclub and bars, Vaughn went into the low-income housing business. From New York, Only a Game's John Kalish reports that Vaughn's business career may end up being more important to his legacy than his time on the baseball diamond.
Thessalonica Court is an apartment building in the Mott Haven section of the Bronx with close to 300 units. This place was in distress before Vaughn's company, Omni New York, bought it and spent close to $10 million on rehabilitation. Omni specializes in so-called acquisition rehabs, buying decrepit old buildings and turning them around. All of these apartments get Section 8 subsidies from the federal government.
What our company is based upon is great security. Security is, to us, you know, our staple. Yeah, if you can't secure your property, then you have nothing. You know, you put millions of dollars into a property to rehabilitate it, the only way it stays up is if you secure it.
Vaughn shows me a bank of digital video recorders near the building's entrance. A bunch of computer monitors display live video feeds from 96 different cameras around the complex.
This camera is watching this camera. That camera's watching this camera. You know, if you open the stairwell, you know, you can see cameras here, camera here, all the way up. So you can't hide from the cameras.
In addition to the video cameras, Vaughn's company employs retired cops to patrol its properties. This complex in the Bronx has been the scene of homicides, according to Noemi Alamo, a longtime resident. But she says that Big Brother surveillance has led to big improvements.
There's been less incidents, less murderers, more control over the building, and it really has made like a 360-degree turn. Everything has really, really been much better.
In addition to securing the building, Mo Vaughn's company has fixed it up physically, and that's involved more than just the peach-colored paint job for the hallways. Again, tenant Noemi Alamo.
We had a definite makeover. We cannot complain. We got everything. Cabinets, refrigerator, stove, boiler, windows. We were lucky. We lucked out.
Mo Vaughn's company has 180 employees and owns 4,000 units of low-income housing, mostly in New York City, but also in upstate New York, Massachusetts, and Wyoming. The day I caught up with him, the hulking 42-year-old Vaughn wore dress slacks, a brown silk T-shirt, and two diamond-studded hoop earrings.
I just believe that everybody deserves a chance. Did I live in, you know, multifamily houses as a kid growing up? No, I didn't. I tend to think I lived a pretty good life, a pretty solid life. I had both parents, and we didn't struggle.
Vaughn grew up in Norwalk, Connecticut, where his mom, Shirley, was an elementary school teacher. His dad, Leroy, was a high school principal and football coach. But it was his mother who taught him to play baseball when he was only 3 years old.
Whatever has come out of me as a man and as a person, as a parent, as a businessman, I've gotten from both my parents, definitely. Whether it was my competitive edge from my mother, whether it was to be a man and step up and have some values from my father, I think all those things have transformed me into a better person.
Vaughn's parents are retired now and live in Virginia, where he says they are partying with college friends. Former pro basketball player Tate George knew Vaughn when the first baseman was setting batting records at Seton Hall University in New Jersey. George remembers the impact Vaughn's parents had on him during his college days in the late 1980s.
We'd be leaving the gym or leaving the field, and he'd be out there cleaning the field. And he was like the star of the university at the time. And I was like, "Mom, why are you doing this?" He said, "Hey, listen, my mom always told me that where you play is your home and you need to take care of it." And he had all these ideas about, you know, what that was ingrained in him. And I think his business reflects that. He didn't lose the humbleness of that time of cleaning the field and being one of the guys. And he really, I think, has maneuvered himself into a space that fits what Mo does well. And that's just being with people.
"What's up, my man? Come here. Come here. We'll be doing a little interview. Stay right here."
Vaughn interrupts our interview when a shy young boy approaches us on the playground behind the Thessalonica Court apartment complex. Many of the tenants are aware of his career in professional baseball.
"You know, everybody's standing on their feet chanting your name, you know, 35,000 people in Fenway Park, you know, played out in L.A. in a big stadium, he played in New York in a big stadium. And, you know, when you retire, it goes radio silence. And there's plenty of days I looked at myself wondering what was going to be my identity going forward. I think every athlete looks at that. To be able to get involved with this and the success that this has had so far going forward, I'm grateful.
Like Mo Vaughn, Tate George went from being a pro ball player to a real estate developer. George, who played in the NBA for the New Jersey Nets and the Milwaukee Bucks, has projects involving affordable housing in Newark, New Jersey.
It's one thing to make money, and it's another thing to do something socially responsible and give back, but it's a gift when you can match them together.
If you ask Mo Vaughn how his company is doing, the former Slugger will tell you it's doing well, but declines to get specific about earnings. He travels between his homes in New York and Florida in a customized bus. You can't help but get the sense that Vaughn's itinerary these days involves a mission of sorts.
I honestly think that my affordable housing career has made me a better person. I think, you know, when you live the life of an athlete, as I've lived it, and Lord knows I made a tremendous amount of money, I think we tend to forget the realities of everything. When this is over, I think what I've done here will be far greater than what I've done in the baseball field, and that's fine with me. This is the path that's been given to me, and I'm walking with it.
For Only a Game, I'm John Kalish in New York.
In Scotland, they knew him as the Wee Iceman. Ben Hogan, whose success on the golf course was derived from his will and his extraordinary concentration, was charitably characterized as unapproachable. When Chris Cheddar became a junior member of the country club where Hogan spent much of his retirement, she heard tales of a loner who was cold on his good days and curt the rest of the time. Stay out of his way, Chris Cheddar was told. And then the teenaged golfer and the retired Iceman became friends and golfing buddies. In Mr. Hogan, The Man I Knew, Chris Cheddar tells the story of her friendship with Ben Hogan. She joins me now from WUCF in Orlando. Chris Cheddar, welcome to Only a Game.
Thank you. It's great to be here.
When you first arrived at Shady Oaks Country Club in Fort Worth in 1984 as a college golfer, you were given one piece of advice, actually more of an order, leave Mr. Hogan alone. How did your connection with Ben Hogan get beyond that injunction?
To be honest with you, I'm not really sure. It just sort of happened over time. I was told, you don't approach him. If he wants to talk to you, he'll talk to you, but leave him alone. And I tried to do that. I would act like I didn't see him when he would walk by. It was crazy. And, you know, I'd say hello to every other man that walked by, and then I'd see him and turn the other direction. And finally, I just said, this is ridiculous. I am going to just be myself because I can't be anyone else. And I would see him, I'd say hello, and he was always very polite. And then he started stopping and giving me a tip here or there, or he would walk by and throw me a candy bar, telling me it was my lunch, and walk on. Eventually, we were practicing together. I mean, now I look back and I can't remember a time that I would go out to the club and practice that he didn't come out.
You weren't there when it happened, of course, but do you know how the Leave Mr. Hogan Alone business got started?
I think that it was just the club trying to protect him. He was a very private man, and I think he appreciated in some ways that Shady Oaks was his escape, but I think also it was in a lot of ways he lost out because late in his life, he didn't have some of the friendships that maybe he would have had.
You mentioned this business about his tossing a candy bar to you and saying, here's your lunch, as he roared by in his golf cart. I assume that was a gesture of affection.
Well, it was, but it was kind of funny because at first I'm thinking, is he trying to tell me I should eat my lunch out on the practice range? Or is he trying to tell me this is all I get for lunch? I wasn't really sure.
One clue to the depth of your friendship with Ben Hogan surfaces in a story that you tell in the book about a fairly high-stakes match that you and your brother Mike were playing at Shady Oaks about 25 years ago. Explain how the mere presence of Ben Hogan helped you out on that day.
Well, we were playing a match, and we just got in over our heads. It was just one of those days where things weren't going our way, and we were losing a lot of money by the turn. And my brother said to me, "Why don't you go see if Mr. Hogan wants to come out and watch a few holes?" So I went in and told him he should come out and get some fresh air, and he did, thank goodness. He showed up on the 11th green, and you could just see the demeanor of our playing partners change. And he watched us play 12, which was only a par 3, and then he watched us tee off on 13, and these poor guys were never the same.
So they were terrified. They were frightened to death.
Everyone was. Everyone that would play 9 or 18 at Shady Oaks would be choking like you can't believe. Just knowing, just thinking of the possibility that he might be sitting in there watching. And you just never knew. But chances are from 12 to about 5 o'clock, he would be sitting at that table that faced out towards 9 and 18 greens, mm-hmm. and rolling his eyes, I'm sure, at some of the shots he saw.
You were already an accomplished amateur golfer when you met Ben Hogan. You'd won 3 state championships back home. Did he either encourage or discourage you in terms of a professional career?
He was just very supportive of whatever I wanted to do. And I had some physical problems sort of early on that I talked to him about, and I was pretty upset. The doctors had told me that chances are I wouldn't be able to play professional golf because I had these shoulders, very loose jointed shoulders that were popping out, you know, when I would swing. And he was real encouraging at that time, saying, don't listen to the doctors. You can do whatever you want to do.
Of course, Ben Hogan was the champion of overcoming physical difficulties. This is a guy who had a traffic accident so terribly serious that they told him he'd never walk again, let alone play golf, and he had some of his greatest triumphs after that.
Right, and that was one thing I asked him one time, if he hit it as well after the accident as before, and he said, not even close. And then that was it. Nothing. He gave me no more insight.
So we just have to imagine how great, perhaps the greatest golfer would have been if he hadn't had that accident.
Well, and how much longer he might have played, and how much more he would have played. I mean, after the accident, he never again played even close to a full schedule. His legs couldn't take it.
When you won an LPGA tournament in 1992, your favorite golf teacher was still alive, and you were able to tell him, hey, you can add an LPGA win to your resume. He said, about time. But how did he take that news?
Oh, he was very, very happy for me. I think more than anything, people missed his sense of humor. They were always so nervous when they were talking to him. They were thinking about the next thing they were going to say, that a lot of times he would say something funny and they just wouldn't get it. But for him to say that, I mean, it's what I expected, because he was just very, very funny. And our conversations were kind of like that, just a lot of banter. And, you know, for him to say, well, geez, it's about time. I mean, it was perfect.
Chris Cheddar is a veteran of the LPGA Tour and the author with Steve Eubanks of Mr. Hogan, The Man I Knew, an LPGA Player Looks Back on an Amazing Friendship and the Lessons She Learned from Golf's Greatest Legend. Gotham Books published it, and Chris Cheddar joined me from WUCF in Orlando. Chris, thank you very much for speaking with me.
Well, thank you for having me.
You're listening to Only a Game. In a commentary on the show last week, I applauded Eric Peterson, the head of school at St. George's in Rhode Island, for pulling the school's football team out of a game against Lawrence Academy of Groton, Massachusetts. Lawrence had several linemen who outweighed the lads from St. George's by as much as 150 pounds, and Mr. Peterson was concerned for the safety of his players. Liz Larkham was among many who saw it his way. "Cheers to Mr. Peterson," she wrote. "As a mother of six athletes, one over 6'5", 240 pounds, it's such a great feeling to see common sense prevail." A listener identifying himself as Greg Mack had another take on the controversy. "The game was on the schedule," he wrote. "It should have been played. Adjustments can always be made by two reasonable coaches to make the game competitive." A listener named Eddie went one step further. "St. George's will always be known as quitters," he wrote. "If it is too hard, then give up. What a great message to teach kids." Colin Callahan, who coached the girls' cross-country team at St. Paul's School in New Hampshire from 1984 until 2004, reads the message differently. "Thank you for your commentary about the football controversy," she wrote. "It takes moral courage in this competitive, college-driven academic environment to do the right thing. The players at St. George's just experienced a life lesson that will make them all better athletes and sportsmen." In response to the story on last week's program about the hybrid sport combining chess and boxing, Mike Quinn wrote, "I couldn't help but wondering what's next. Jiu-jitsu, Jim Rummy, bare knuckle, pinochle, contact bridge?" I like all those possibilities, particularly contact bridge if it's contact contract bridge. It just has a nice ring to it. And finally, regarding the reporter who contributed the story set in India last week, Dr. David Warren wrote, "Ms. Anjali Nair has a beautiful voice and an interesting story. She does say that she feels she has special shooting skills in her genetic makeup, and so she expects to fire her weapon with accuracy. I wonder if she would as readily take ownership of the negative sides of India's character, whatever they may be." Let us know what you think of the show by contacting us through the website, onlyagame.org. You can leave a message on the listener line by calling 617-353-1860. And you can find us on Facebook and follow us on Twitter at Only A Game Radio. It's 22 and a half minutes before the hour.
Support for Only a Game comes from the listeners of WBUR Boston, where the program is produced. Oliver Wyman, an international strategy consulting firm. With 3,000 professionals worldwide, Oliver Wyman serves global 1,000 companies. OliverWyman.com. And Nuance, offering Dragon speech recognition software for creating documents and emails and surfing the web all by speaking. At nuance.com/NPR. This is NPR.
Of a new video game he'd begun playing, Ian Wolverton said it's quite fun and it's addictive. Mr. Wolverton is a spokesperson for Save the Children in Australia, and the game in which he'd become absorbed required no blasting of zombies or destruction of evil space pods. Instead, Earthquake Response challenges players to acquire tents, water, and medical attention for AirSat's victims of earthquakes and other natural disasters occurring in cyberspace. The idea is for players to save as many lives as they can, and according to Ian Wolverton, there's a serious message in it about what we do in times of emergencies. All of which is fine, I guess, as long as Earthquake Response includes a part Angelina Jolie can play when they turn it into a movie. I'm Bill Littlefield. Coming up on Only a Game, Lombardi hopes to pack him in on Broadway. But first, I'm joined by Charlie Pierce, who's in New York himself this week, for a look at the week's news. Hello, Charlie.
Hi, Bill.
Okay, there are only four teams left in the baseball playoffs now. Time for you to pick a World Series winner.
Excellent. How wrong can I be? There are only four teams left. Hey, I could be 75% wrong. If you're asking me what World Series I want to see, I want to see Texas and Philadelphia. If you're asking me what World Series I think I'm going to see, it's Philadelphia and New York, and I think Philadelphia beats them this year. There's too much starting pitching on the Philadelphia Phillies.
After serving a four-game suspension, Pittsburgh Steelers quarterback Ben Roethlisberger will make his 2010 debut tomorrow against the Cleveland Browns. The Steelers are 3-1 without Big Ben. Do you think they maybe considered keeping him on the bench?
Well, no, because the alternative is Charlie Batch, and I think if they play Charlie Batch for like two more games, they have to pay a kickback to the AARP. So this is saving the money by bringing Roethlisberger back.
Inez Sainz, the Mexican TV reporter who was harassed in the Jets locker room last month, will be back on the job next week, but she says she would rather not go into the locker room. She'd prefer to talk to the players on the field or on the sideline instead. Does that sound to you like a reasonable request?
Who wouldn't, by the way?
I agree.
Poll the people who do sports media. I certainly think that if that's the way she wants to do her job, that's the way she should be allowed to do her job.
The BCS won't release its first standings of the season until Monday.
Liars!
But according to the prediction that I have in front of me, if the ranking were to be released early, as of, say, today, Boise State would be number one. So, too soon to celebrate?
I find that very hard to believe, and I'd be very interested to know the source of that particular speculation because, that, I mean, as much as we all adore Boise State and they're a great story, the best win they have is against a mediocre Virginia Tech team. And how that puts them ahead of people like LSU and Nebraska and Oregon, I have no idea. This has got to be even higher math than the BCS is used to.
In a Sports Illustrated story, former sports agent Josh Lux acknowledges that he paid more than 30 college players between 1990 and 1996. He names lots of names, including Ryan Leaf and Chris Mims. Anything surprising here beyond the specifics?
Well, I think that the fact that he gave up actual names and actual amounts is surprising that he gave up the names. It's not surprising that he did it to anybody who's been awake the last 30 years. Everybody knows this is going on. I sound like I'm beating the same tin drum on this over and over and over again, but the current amateur imperatives of college sports at the highest level are not sustainable. They will crash, and the only question is how loud will the crash be and who will walk away?
Ole Miss has picked a new mascot, something called the Rebel Black Bear, and I was disappointed that the Rebel Land Shark didn't make the cut. My money was on him, but there was apparently a very strong internet contingent pushing for Admiral Akbar from the Star Wars movies. Who had your vote?
It's a trick!
So it was the Admiral.
It's a trick! I wanted to be the mascot! The problem is, I'd spit all over things.
I think probably there might have been a copyright issue as well. But I'm not entirely sure of that.
I don't know.
The NBA Players Association has threatened legal action against the league over new rules on technical fouls. The Players Association is concerned that calling technical fouls for relatively minor offenses could result in, quote, a stifling of the players' passion and exuberance for their work. Wouldn't the millions and millions of dollars they're paid create sufficient passion and exuberance?
I'm of two minds about this. I mean, they're starting to call technical fouls for nasty looks. They're calling technical fouls for insubordinate shrugs of the shoulder. I mean, given what's gone on with NBA referees in the last 20 years, anybody in that job should be lucky that people aren't looking at them sideways. I hope this lightens up when the regular season starts. I'm not a fan of long arguments with officials, but just because a guy turns and glares at you doesn't mean you're diminished in the eyes of your family and the rest of the House of Atreus. Get over it.
Gilbert Arenas of the Washington Wizards was fined by his team this week after he pretended to be injured so that teammate Nick Young would have the opportunity to start in an exhibition game. And then the following game, Mr. Arenas played for only 3 minutes before he got injured. I guess we're supposed to believe the second one was real.
God was watching, Gilbert. God doesn't like phony injuries. God was watching
you. There's a story about the little boy who cried wolf.
Boy who cried hamstring.
NASCAR's second Hall of Fame class was announced this week, Charlie. As Mr. NASCAR is no doubt clearly aware, NASCAR only elects 5 members each year, so on the list of those snubbed this season were 3-time champions Darrell Waltrip and Cale Yarborough. Are you suitably outraged?
Yeah, I'm not exactly sure how this happened. Usually when you start up a Hall of Fame, and if you look in the case of baseball, the first couple of classes were enormous because you're catching up.
Mm-hmm.
But the idea that Darrell Waltrip and Cale Yarborough didn't get in on the first ballot is hilarious. That having been said, it's a very big class for daddies. You had Ned Jarrett, whose son was a tremendous driver, and you had, of course, Lee Petty, whose son and grandson all both drive, but whose son is probably the biggest star NASCAR ever produced outside of Dale Earnhardt.
Tommy Smith and John Carlos earned iconic status when they raised their black-gloved fists and bowed their heads while standing on the podium at the 1968 Olympics in Mexico City. This week, Tommy Smith announced that his gold medal from those games is going to be for sale. Bidding starts at $250,000. Will you be raising your bid paddle?
This is one of those, I hope some anonymous millionaire buys it and gives it back to him for like a dollar. This is really, I mean, he says he's not doing it for the money, but $250,000 means you're doing it for the money. I think the saddest part of the story, Bill, is they asked him where the glove was, and he doesn't know.
Yeah, it's gone. In our ongoing coverage of the Commonwealth Games and the aftermath of same, it behooves me to report that Ronnie Yadav, an Indian race walker, has tested positive for steroids. Really? A race walker?
Hey, listen, the guy was trying to get away from monkeys. He was trying to get away from cobras. He was trying to find a men's room that wasn't choked with used prophylactics. The guy needed some speed at the Commonwealth Games. I don't blame him at all.
And finally, Charlie, 16-year-old Canadian pop star Justin Bieber is taking issue with Patriots quarterback Tom Brady's use of his signature hairdo. What do you think of the rap lyrics, "Sack like a sacker, call up Mr. Brady, tell him to leave his hair to the guy that sings Baby"?
I don't know what that means. Who's the guy that sings Baby?
Well, that would be, I assume, Justin Bieber. You're asking me. Even my children are too old to know anything about Justin Bieber.
I think we've already heard too much about Tom Brady's hair. And I know we've already heard too much about Justin Bieber.
Charlie Pierce is the author of Idiot America, among other books. He joins me each week at this time on Only a Game. Thank you, Charlie.
Thanks, Bill. It's a trap. You know you love me.
If you're perplexed by Patsy Cline, flummoxed by Fugazi, or bamboozled by Bartok, Brubeck, or Booker T and the MGs, please visit onlyagame.org to learn more about the music you hear on Only a Game. This week, Billy Hunter, the director of the NBA Players Union, lodged a protest regarding the league's new rule about calling technical fouls. The officials have been instructed to whistle guys who make demonstrative gestures, continue to complain about calls after they've been instructed to stop, or approach an official in an aggressive manner. As a result, technical fouls in the current preseason are running somewhat ahead of the number called during the same period last fall. In theory, Mr. Hunter wouldn't seem to have much of a gripe. If players and coaches can be coerced into complaining less, perhaps the flow of the game will be interrupted less often. But in practice, the new rule has produced some troubling consequences. During Wednesday night's game between the Boston Celtics and the New York Knicks, Timofey Mozgov, whom the Knicks discovered in Russia, was called for a technical foul for mumbling in his native language as he walked past one of the officials. Odds are the official had no idea what Mr. Mozgov was muttering. Perhaps it was the Russian equivalent of, "Oh, gee, I forgot to pick up milk and bread, and by the time this game is over, the grocery store will be closed and my wife's gonna kill me." Then there's the subjective decision about what constitutes an aggressive manner when a player approaches an official. If you are a middle-aged guy trying to conceal your spare tire in a pair of polyester trousers much too tight, a guy who's maybe 5'10 and sporting a comb-over, isn't anybody who's 7 feet tall and 300 thoroughly conditioned rock-hard pounds going to seem at least vaguely aggressive when he's approaching you in his customary seven-league strides, even if he's smiling as if he's just remembered a good joke? Billy Hunter's argument against the new rule is that, quote, it may actually harm the product by stifling the player's passion and exuberance for their work. Lots of fans would argue that the expansion of the NBA season over the years has already poked a substantial hole in that passion and exuberance, and in the past, even the players themselves have acknowledged that it's impossible to be passionate and exuberant for 82-plus nights. Maybe that's the real reason they've been giving the officials a hard time.
We've got shirts that say Lombardi, decorated with the image of a football field surrounding the name. A few hats that say Lombardi on Broadway, and some nice little buttons that also say Lombardi on Broadway, all with the football field logo.
At the table in the lobby of the theater in Great Barrington, Massachusetts, where a new play, Lombardi, staged an out-of-town tryout in July, a young woman named Emmeline selling Lombardi-related merchandise had her hands full. Everyone wants a piece of Lombardi, she said. After that evening's performance, at least two of the members of the audience, Ken and Ina, seemed pleased with the production.
Oh, we loved it. It was great. It was terrific acting. Dan, Loria, was unbelievable.
Yeah, the acting was really quite amazing. That's what caught us
and
immediately.
Judith Light, I think. They were all fine, but they were very strong.
Dan Loria plays the iconic Green Bay Packers coach, Judith Light, his long-suffering and hard-drinking wife, Marie. Loria, whom TV viewers may remember as the father in the Wonder Years, makes a convincing Vince Lombardi each time he opens his mouth to bellow.
This is a football. This season will be the start of something new. And with every fiber of my being, I'm going to make you the best football team that I can make you. And I'll try. And I'll try again. And if I don't succeed the first time, I'll try again. And you have got to give everything that's in you in order to stop that play on defense or to make the play go if you're on offense. Because this may be the one play in the whole ballgame that could cause the winning or the losing of the entire season.
Given the way in which lots of football fans came to see Vince Lombardi as a larger-than-life figure, even while he was still leading the Packers to wins in the first two Super Bowls, the danger in building a play around him would seem to be descent into cliché. But as he watched the play in Great Barrington and then retooled it for the Circle and the Square Theater in New York, director Thomas Kail didn't worry about that happening.
I didn't when we had Dan Loria. You know, the reality is Dan understands the fundamental truth about Vince. And I think Eric Simonson, who wrote the play, gave us the blueprint. And my job was to try to build the house from that. And when you have the right people on the team doing so, it makes my job much easier. And the reality is we're never going to capture Vince Lombardi in that moment. We're going to try to get as many essential characteristics. We're going to try to get the essence of the man. And I think that's something that Dan does beautifully.
The play is built around a reporter's week-long visit to the Lombardi home in Green Bay during the coach's glory days with the Packers, but the action drifts backward and forward in time, and one particularly entertaining scene finds Lombardi railing against the forces that he feels have conspired to deny him a head coaching job while his wife tries to tell him about a phone call that he missed.
It's been 15 years! And all that time, I've never been offered a head coaching job on a college or a professional level, in spite of the fact I've been part of only winning traditions. Hell, I got all those winning years on the Red Lake at Army, only winning seasons with the Giants the past 5 years. Hell, we nearly won it all this past season. Everyone says I should be a head coach right now, and nothing. Why? And the only thing I can think of is that my last name ends in a vowel.
Vince.
What?
Are you finished?
Yes.
Jack Vannese called today.
Jack Vannese offers Lombardi the job, of course, an outcome Marie Lombardi anticipated well before her husband had returned the call. The prospective move provoked in her some curiosity about their next home.
Where are you going?
To get an atlas.
David Marinus wrote When Pride Still Mattered, the book upon which the play was in part based. He feels the production does manage to include the most crucial elements of his biography of Lombardi.
Vince Lombardi was a complicated man, an imperfect man striving for perfection, someone who was better able to create a sense of family out of a team than out of his own nuclear family, had a temper and was trying to control it. And all of those elements and many more come out in this play, as they are in my book.
If many of the elements of the play to which David Marinus refers have not changed since the play was presented in Great Barrington several months ago, the same can't be said of the staging. The production in New York includes sound and images borrowed from the NFL, and the lobby of the Circle in the Square features photos of Lombardi and his players. Of course, all the memorabilia in the world would go for naught if those who knew Lombardi didn't feel the play had captured the coach's essence. But according to David Marinus, so far, in previews, the production has succeeded in that regard.
Well, we had one Packer there the other night, Chuck Mercine, who did a talk back with me afterwards. And he thought that Loria was spot on, scary in that sense, and as was the presentation of Marie. So we have many of them coming over the next few weeks and months, and the reaction so far has been that Tommy and Eric got it right.
I suppose the ultimate great reaction would be if an ex-Packer stood up in the audience and started shouting back at Dan Loria.
Good luck.
Mersin almost did it.
Lombardi will open Thursday at the Circle in the Square Theater in New York. Only a Game is produced by Karen Given and Doug Trabu. Our technical director is John Perotti. Jack Flagler is our intern, and we had help this week from Kayon Riley at WUCF in Orlando. Our senior producer is Gary Wallach. To view our photo galleries, subscribe to the Only a Game podcast, listen to archived shows and stories, or learn more about our weekly music selections, please visit our website, onlyagame.org. You can follow us on Facebook and Twitter at Only a Game Radio. Our final word this week comes from Vince Lombardi.
What the hell's going on out here?
It's called a play, Coach. That guy's only pretending to be you. You ought to get off the sidelines and into the theater more often. I'm Bill Littlefield. Thanks for listening. I'll see you next week.
Support comes from LendingTree, providing up to 4 loan offers from a network of lenders. Learn more at LendingTree.com or 800-555-TREE. The Annie E. Casey Foundation, promoting lifelong family connections for children and youth in foster care. On the web at AECF.org. And the John D. and Catherine T. MacArthur Foundation, committed to building a more just, verdant, and peaceful world. More information at MacFound.org. This is NPR.